It's Publius's weekend update show.
Im igen, it'll be me jaga in.
We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Now, as I always say, I do look forward to your cards and letters. And in that vein, I have had a letter from SDF member CSH who says, I enjoy listening to your program. Thank you very much. And just as a note, if I say I'm going to do something, and it doesn't really sound like something a normal person would do, it's very likely that I am, in fact, going to do exactly that thing. Just so you know. Speaking of things I am doing or planning to do or saying I am planning to do. So, the 15th through 19th of this month is the World Science Fiction Convention. That's going to be held in Washington, D.C. Now, I had been bugging the organizers about doing something atomic energy related. I was proposing to engage, participate in the programming tracks, to have a display or something, get them to do a tour or something. No response, nothing. I did, however, in anticipation of getting some response to them, design a booklet or pamphlet, a trifold brochure or something, to hand out, which I am going to print some of them up and hand them out. I just am, all right? That's, But what is the reason for this booklet? Well, you can perhaps figure that out from the title, which I've given it, Atomic Power 70 Years. So here's the text for you, which lined itself neatly into columns. I had to say, I did not expect that. On the 20th of December, 1951, in the arid steppe of central Idaho, a new chapter in human history was being written. Heat released by the nuclear fission chain reaction in the core of experimental breeder reactor number 1 was employed to raise steam and spin a turbo alternator. 1 kilowatt of electricity was generated and used to illuminate a string of 10 100-watt incandescent light bulbs. The next day, output was raised to 100 kilowatts and supplied the needs of the EBR-1 facility. 9 years before, 2nd December 1942 in Chicago, the fission chain reaction in uranium, not even conceived of in scientific theory until the autumn of 1938, had been initiated under human control for the first time. That accomplishment was a closely guarded secret, because a terrible war was raging at the time, and there was fear that the outcome might be decided by the release of atomic energy. It was only revealed to the general public in the terrifying glare of the explosion which destroyed the city of Hiroshima. With that revelation, the world was put in terrible suspense. Had science betrayed the faith humanity reposed in it? Must this new force remain a menace and a horror, or could it be harnessed to serve man and his civilization? The generation of electricity, which had itself gone from a scientific curiosity less than 100 years before to the ubiquitous silent servant, supplier of light, heat, and motive force, was proof positive of the domestication of the atom, but this was only a part of the purpose of EBR-1 and not the greater part. Of all substances found in nature, only the rare isotope uranium-235 will support a fission chain reaction. Although uranium is more common in the crust of the Earth than silver, each ton as it comes from the mine contains only 7 kilograms of U-235. In a power reactor, that one ton will do the work of about 10,000 tons of coal. The amount of uranium which can be mined, up to 10,000 times the price per ton of coal, is estimated at no more than 10 million tons. 100 billion tons of coal sounds like a vast amount, until we realize that already by 1952, the world was consuming annually some 2 billion tons, or the equivalent in other fossil fuels. It seems, therefore, that the fission chain reaction, even though it dips into the intranuclear strong force, the deepest well of energy in nature, cannot contribute much to the needs of the world. An atom of the common isotope, uranium-238, however, contains just as much potential energy as one of U-235. If this could be released, each ton of uranium would do the work of 1 million tons of coal. 10 million tons of cheap uranium would then represent several times as much fuel as all the coal that can be mined, all the oil and gas that can be pumped, taken together. The supply of uranium, up to 1 million times the price of coal, is certainly immense. It could be obtained from seawater more cheaply than that. Another heavy element, thorium, may be called upon as well. More plentiful than uranium, it contains as much potential energy, but no fissile material. Then there would be no reason that civilization should ever run short of the cheap energy needed to support a high level of culture. There would be no reason ever to fall back into a world of a few lords and masters and masses of peasants, serfs, and slaves. It was first and foremost for this purpose that EBR-1 was built. The fission of U-235 releases, in addition to heat, neutrons which can be used to transmute one element into another. Ordinary uranium becomes a new substance, plutonium, which itself will support a chain reaction and promote further transmutation. Under the right conditions, plutonium can be produced faster than it is used up. Thus, the whole energy of uranium is gradually made available. EBR-1 and its successors, direct and indirect, EBR-2, DFR, PFR, Phoenix, SuperPhoenix, and more, have explored the problems of regenerating fuel while producing power. We can confidently say, on the basis of the results obtained, that the production of energy with fuel breeding is not much more difficult than the present non-regenerative nuclear energy, and that is now largely a matter of routine engineering practice. What does this mean? Delving in pits beneath the earth for black rocks to burn, fouling the air with smoke, is obsolete. There is no more reason for the existence of global have-nots, peoples unable to afford the means of living decent lives. No nation need fear for its energy supply. The wars over fossil fuels, which have plagued our world as much as those over the old energy sources of land and fodder, are pointless. It was in just such a war that the atomic bomb was used in anger. We may pray for the last time. Atomic energy cannot bring us a world of peace and prosperity. That will take wisdom, but it gives us the power to achieve what we are wise enough to do. And then the overleaf of the booklet here. The overleaf of the booklet says, historical note, and I had to do a little research for this, and it was a little tricky. I didn't quite find the information I was looking for, but I got as close as I could. Although EBR-1 can fairly be called the first nuclear reactor to generate electricity, and certainly provided the first practical demonstration of the generation of electricity from fission, there are two other reactors which must be considered in this context, both graphite uranium piles cooled by air. In August 1948, an experimental apparatus containing uranium slugs and water was inserted into the X-10 pile at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. The fission heat evolved in turn produced a small quantity of steam, which operated a toy steam engine, turning a dynamo and lighting a flashlight bulb. This represents an early example of the technique of in-pile loops, which has become a principal tool of reactor development. Also in 1948, the British experimental pile, BEPO, was completed at Harwell in England. In post-war Britain, where fuel shortages were a fact of life, arrangements were made to blow the air leaving the reactor over a heat exchanger. The water thus warmed could be used to heat the laboratory and office buildings at the Harwell site. It appears that this heating plant only went into operation in the autumn of 1951. Hence, it may claim the title of first useful application of fission energy, but only by a few weeks. EBR-1 itself operated for more than 10 years, with three different experimental cores. It supported a variety of research activities, including one test of abnormal operation which resulted in a partial core meltdown. On 26 August 1966, it was designated a National Historic Landmark by President Johnson, who received one of the original 10 light bulbs to commemorate the occasion. X1 says the British reactor that did not catch fire. No, that was one of the two wind-scale plutonium production piles. Blah. Anyway, the boilerplate text on the back, which is to say, when you fold up a trifold, there's one panel which is sort of the back. Anyway, where I've put the mailing address and web address. Anyway, and I'm going to put a logo on there. And then the boilerplate text says, "The control of intra-atomic energy by means of the fission chain reaction must be counted among the great achievements of the human intellect. That the energy so liberated now lights and heats homes and turns the wheels of industry from Argentina to Korea is a true sign of hope in our times, and our world today needs hope. Man has begun to make himself master over the forces which light the stars and shape the galaxies, and with them over his own destiny. It is ours to choose the upward way, to meet the challenge of the cosmos, or to turn our backs upon the heights and accept the atom and the rocket as messengers of our destruction." And then I have in italic, bold, and centered, "All the universe or nothing, which shall it be?" Which, of course, is the challenge from the end of the movie Things to Come. It doesn't seem to be at least phrased that way in the book, Shape of Things to Come. And I don't know to what extent H.G. Wells was responsible for the script of the film version of Things to Come. In other words, I don't know whether he is the one who wrote that line or whether someone else wrote it. But that's the message I'm always trying to send, right? Is that at the last year of the Second World War, the space rocket and the control of atomic energy both appeared, and they appeared in the most terrible form that they could, as messengers of death and destruction plunging down on Antwerp and London and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that is the most terrible warning, right? Because that is what we get if we don't make the choice to go into space. If we don't make the choice to use uranium and thorium and plutonium for the betterment of mankind, what happens? What do we get? The people who are willing to burn and destroy will be the only ones using those technologies. So yes, I've also almost quoted Arthur C. Clarke in the blurb there. To turn our backs upon the still untrodden heights, that's from The Promise of Space, which is published in the spring of 69, I think. Ha! Managed to grab the book without it getting out of my chair too far. After having to go around to the other side of the bookshelf. I just reached around it. But Chapter 30 of The Promise of Space by Arthur C. Clarke, Concerning Ends and Means, deserves to be read. But what I have there is a what I have there is a is like I say quasi quotation. Just the last couple of paragraphs here. I'm going to read them to you because I think they're enormously poetic, and they never fail to move me. "There will, it is true, be danger in space, as there has always been on the oceans or in the air. Some of these dangers we may guess, others we shall not know until we meet them. Nature is no friend of man's, and the most that he can hope for is her neutrality. But if he meets destruction, it will be at his own hands and according to a familiar pattern. The dream of flight was one of the noblest and one of the most disinterested of all man's aspirations, yet it led in the end to that B-29 driving in passionless beauty through August skies toward the city whose name it was to sear into the conscience of the world. Already there has been half-serious talk concerning the use of the moon for military bases and launching sites. The crossing of space may thus bring not a new renaissance, but the final catastrophe that haunts our generation. That is the danger, the dark thundercloud that threatens the promise of the dawn. The rocket has already been the instrument of evil, and may be so again, but there is no way back into the past. The choice, as Wells once said, is the universe or nothing. See, so I'm quasi-quoting Clark, who's quasi-quoting Wells. Though men and civilizations may yearn for rest for the dream of the Lotus Eaters, that is a desire that merges imperceptibly into death. The challenge of the great spaces between the worlds is a stupendous one, but if we fail to meet it, the story of our race will be drawing to its close. Humanity will have turned its back upon the still untrodden heights and will be descending the long slope that stretches across 1,000,000,000 years of time down to the shores of the primeval sea. But I have here a letter from the White House. It says so. Return address, The White House, Washington, D.C., 20500. Now, why would I be receiving mail from the White House? Well, the short answer is that I wrote mail to the White House, or rather to the President of the United States. Why would I write to the President of the United States? Now, this was a bit ago. This was in March, so it's been 8 months almost. Yeah? Yeah. In fact, March 26th, so it's been 8 months. And this is what I wrote, and now we'll see what I just opened the envelope, so I don't know what's in this letter. We'll see what the response is from the White House. Probably something banal, right? Probably something completely banal. Tin says, wasn't one of the ideas behind the Crusades to export the violence that was destroying European societies and projected outwards? Well, certainly St. Catherine of Siena said, if these men must fight, let them go and fight the Turk. It's certainly Ferdinand and Isabella and their conquistadores. To be perfectly blunt, the conquistadores were a group of people that had existed for a long time. They've been engaged in the Reconquista, the recovery of Spain from the Moors. Well, 1492 comes along. Castile and Leon conquer Granada, and suddenly there is no more Spain to recover from the Moors. They've got it all. Well, what are they going to do with these people whose entire livelihood is based on violence and who completely scorn to engage in any useful activities with their lives, consider it beneath them? Well, the answer, this Columbus guy shows up and says, "You wouldn't believe where I've been." And they say, "Oh, thank heaven, we can just ship all these people off to, where was it you said again, Japan?" Yeah, it's not going to matter. As long as they're out of here, we'll be fine. That was perhaps a miscalculation. Aside from the fact that Ferdinand was apparently paranoid and got the idea that every single Muslim and Jew in the entire Kingdom of Spain was engaged in a single grand plot against his life, which, you know, all I have to say about that is anybody who talks about the Jewish conspiracy has never met any actual Jews. I've never met a group of people who were less likely to agree on something. In fact, there's a rabbinical proverb that says, two Jews, three opinions. Anyway, but he deports them all. He expels them from Spain. A lot of them went to the Papal State. The Pope at the time, who was a Spaniard, said, Ferdinand has impoverished his own kingdom to enrich mine. And then, not more than a few years later, the treasure fleets began to come back from the New World. As it turns out, importing a bunch of gold and silver into a country where the people who own the land are already highly disinclined to engage in any kind of trade or manufacturing activity tends to implode your economy. Importing money, as it turns out, isn't a good idea. And so Spain wound up kind of like, I don't know, Saudi Arabia or something. You know, these countries nowadays that they pump out oil and they sell oil and they have no industries. Everyone there lives off of oil revenue. I've commented about Saudi Arabia and Venezuela and countries like that in the past on this show, that selling raw materials and resources and then using the revenue that you get to buy finished goods is not a great plan, people. Anyway, and so the result was, you know, that Spain limped by as the wealthiest poor country in the world for about 200 years, and then the colonies really got fed up, and a lot of them declared their independence. And, you know, without Mexico and Peru, suddenly the Spain didn't have those sources of revenue, and it just became a void economically and so on. You know, and then, of course, you have the problems of really terrible land, you know, and agricultural practices. Overgrazing by sheep. Let's see, Northern Lights mentions cutting forests to make ships. Of course, that is why France and England were interested in North America. Mast timber. That the forests of Virginia and Quebec meant great big tall old growth pine and other kinds of trees that would make masts for ships. But, of course, James Burke's Connections, where he talks about how the burning of coal was related to the demand for charcoal and so on. Very interesting, interesting stuff. But, yeah, so there was a period when the two powers of the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, nominally controlled most of the land area of the earth, but they didn't have enough real wealth, starting with capable people, to actually do anything with it. So their empires were never more than hollow shells. But yeah, deforestation is a problem. Afforestation is a very desirable thing. It's interesting to note that the primary colonial policy that the Japanese pursued in Korea, China, elsewhere, that wasn't totally idiotic, was afforestation. Let's see, mention of the Cedars of Lebanon in ComChat. If you're wondering, this is another thing about the SDF Public Access Unix system, is ComChat, which is not IRC. That's the main thing, right? Anyway, yeah, but in fact, Lebanese coinage has the famous cedars on it. But let me read you the letter that I sent to the president, and then we'll see what banal reply I got, okay? Mr. President, I consider it a matter of great urgency to bring to your attention a crucial weakness in our country's foreign affairs which I have nowhere seen discussed. The negotiating position of the United States vis-a-vis the Islamic Republic of Iran with respect to the nuclear energy program of that country is severely compromised by the present open and material breach of nuclear disarmament obligations on the part of the USA. Under the Nunn-Lugar agreements with Russia, the United States is positively obligated to put 34 tons of plutonium from decommissioned thermonuclear warheads beyond future military use by degrading its isotopic quality. In layman's terms, that means to convert the plutonium into reactor fuel and use it up. This is the raw material of something like 6,000 atom bombs. Down to the present day, none of it has been made into fuel, much less loaded into a reactor. Owing to institutional hostility within the U.S. government to the civil use of plutonium, great effort has been expended on, quote, alternative disposition strategies, with the ludicrous exception of building special non-power-producing disposal reactors. None of these so-called alternatives meets the terms of the Plutonium Management and Disposition Agreement, and none of them would prevent future use of the material in weapons. The negotiators of the Islamic Republic would certainly be able to make much of the failure of the United States to meet its obligations to turn over such a large quantity of weapons material to civil use. What moral high ground, they might ask, could the only country ever to actually use nuclear weapons possibly claim to demand that Iran accept restrictions on its civil atomic energy activities when it cannot be bothered to fulfill its own obligations, which it took on voluntarily and for its own benefit. Russia has, after all, fulfilled its end of the bargain, both by converting weapons plutonium into civil fuel and by downblending some 500 tons of bomb-grade uranium to the level of enrichment use in power reactors. This fuel-grade uranium was then shipped to the United States, where it supplied about half of our civil nuclear fuel requirements, 10% of our total electricity consumption over two decades. The matter has, however, far broader strategic implications. Over the past century, access to fossil fuels has been central to international conflicts. In the coming 50 years, that is, on the basis of current trends, very likely to remain true, but the consequences of burning those fuels, in the form of global climate change, will become another powerful force setting nation against nation. The confrontation with Iran is itself driven largely by U.S. support for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The United States has no community of interest with this aggressive, repressive, intolerant despotism, certainly not one strong enough to justify the deployment of U.S. military forces in support of the Saudi invasion of Yemen. But the collapse of the Saudi regime would imperil fuel deliveries to countries in Europe and Asia with which we do have strong common interests. It should come as no surprise in this context that Iran finds a kind of ally in Russia. The success of the pressure campaign against nuclear energy in Germany has left that country avid for imported gas. The resulting revenue stream is crucial to keeping President Putin and his associates in control domestically. More than that, however, the threat of cutting off the heat during the German winter provides a long lever with which to influence NATO and European Union policy. Members of the EU, such as Poland and Hungary, are looking toward Ukraine and seeing their own future, which only helps to drive political extremism in those countries. In a world where decarbonization is a watchword, for the United States as a country which has appointed a special envoy for climate change to set its face against any non-fossil fuel energy source makes very little sense. If fabricated into so-called MOX fuel assemblies for our current light water reactors, 34 tons of plutonium would yield 32.5 gigawatt years, 285 billion kilowatt hours of electricity. This is equivalent to, although of greater practical value than, the lifetime output of over 10 gigawatts of solar installations costing at least $15 billion. For comparison, the largest amount of PV solar generating capacity so far installed in a single year in the USA is 15 gigawatts in 2016. Alternatively, loaded into reactors of the fast neutron breeder type, it would endow approximately 10 gigawatts of electric generating capacity in perpetuity. These reactors could operate indefinitely into the future, requiring as makeup fuel each year about 10 tons out of the well over 500,000 tons of depleted uranium now stored at various sites in this country. Nothing could better fit the definition of ethically sourced sustainable energy. I might bring to your attention that the element plutonium was itself discovered here in the United States. The first nuclear fission chain reactor was built here in the United States, as was the first plutonium-fueled fast reactor. The generation of electricity from fission was first demonstrated here in the United States from, in point of fact, experimental breeder reactor number one. The conversion of plutonium into MOX fuel was pioneered here in the United States. It is time to recommit our nation to the promise made by President Eisenhower when he said, "It is not enough to take this weapon out of the hands of the soldiers. It must be put into the hands of those who will know how to strip its military casing and adapt it to the arts of peace." Respectfully, C.D. Carson. That is, by the way, a quote from the speech made by President Eisenhower in the General Assembly of the United Nations on the 8th of December, 1953, his so-called Atoms for Peace speech, one of the most famous speeches ever made by a president. Now, what do we have here in Joe Biden's signature? I said it would be banal. Here it is. Thank you. Dear C.D. Carson, thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts with me. Hearing from passionate individuals like you inspires me every day, and I welcome the opportunity to respond to your letter. Our country faces many challenges, and the road we will travel together will be one of the most difficult in our history. Despite these tough times, I have never been more optimistic for the future of America. I believe we are better positioned than any country in the world to lead in the 21st century, not just by the example of our power, but by the power of our example. While we may not always agree on how to solve every issue, I pledge to be a president for all Americans. I am confident that we can work together to find common ground to make America a more just, prosperous, and secure nation. As we move forward to address the complex issues of our time, I encourage you to remain an active participant in helping write the next great chapter of the American story. We need your courage and dedication at this critical time, and we must meet this moment together as the United States of America. If we do that, I believe that that our best days will still lie ahead. Sincerely, Joe Biden. So that right there.
7.